From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in this next forum hour, the history of Afghanistan is often understood in terms of invasions. The area has been occupied by the likes of Alexander the Great and Genghis Khan, and more recently, the Soviet Union and the United States-led NATO coalition. But the country has its own compelling story, independent of the interventions, writes San Francisco-based author Tommy Mansari. The Afghan-born author, now San Francisco-based, joins us to discuss his new book, Games Without Rules, The Often Interrupted History of Afghanistan. Next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this hour of our forum program. San Francisco-based author, editor, and educator Tommy Mansari joins us in studio for this forum hour. Born in Afghanistan, he presently directs the San Francisco Writers' Workshop and is the author of Destiny Disputed, A History of the World Through Islamic Eyes, The Widow's Husband, and West of Kabul, East of New York. He's written for the San Francisco Chronicle, Salon, Alternet, Edutopia, Parade, and the LA Times, and recently published a book called Games Without Rules, The Often Interrupted History of Afghanistan. Welcome back to Forum for this hour, and good to have you here.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I guess by way of introduction to your book, we ought to say, as you have said, as you say in the book, five times in the last two centuries, a great power has tried to, I'm quoting you now, invade, conquer, or occupy, or otherwise take control of Afghanistan. And so much of this is tied in with what is perceived as Afghanistan's history as opposed to Afghanistan's history apart from all that.
Yeah. Well, there is a history of the territory itself. That's true.
And you essentially bring it to our attention, which is, I think, an important thing for readers and people interested in that part of the world to realize. But they've all been, all these interventions, first of all, have been failures, as you point out, too.
They certainly have in the last two centuries, you know, because the interventions have these last two centuries, they've all been Western powers coming into Afghanistan, trying to dominate it for reasons that have nothing to do with Afghanistan or even the region. It's always part of some global game. And the powers that come in have no intention, actually, of living in Afghanistan or occupying or colonizing it. They just want to control it for their own purposes. Earlier invasions, the Turks often invaded. They left remnants. The Afghans are the remnants of all the different, the Iranians, the Turks.
They're the conquerors.
They are the conquerors, and they've become the Afghans.
Right.
Yeah.
And the book is based on a game that's really singular in Afghan culture, buzkashi.
Yeah.
And I use this game as a central metaphor for Afghan's history. Tell us about it.
Well, buzkashi, which means goat dragging, was and is a game in which riders on horses swoop in on a goat carcass, grab it off the ground, and try to get it to a certain goalpost. And as they ride off with it, the other riders are riding alongside, trying to grab the goat away, using their horse whips, whatever they can. And as originally played, this game, it had no set size of field. Sometimes a buzkashi game could stretch across miles, or it could be a few hundred feet. It had no set number of players. It had no teams. It had no lines marking where the boundaries of the field were. Had no referees. But people knew how to play the game, and they played it according to, you know, unstated assumptions,
custom,
traditions.
Yeah. And the fact is, there's two games going on simultaneously, which is why it works for you as a metaphor. Yeah.
Yeah, it works for me as a metaphor for that reason. And you know, this way that buzkashi worked as a game originally, for me, is a metaphor for how Afghan society worked originally. Now, on top of that, you have the so-called great game, great powers using Afghanistan as the field of play for their games. Those also are games without rules. I mean, international politics, whatever you can get away with, you do.
In fact, it's striking how much these invading powers kept things separate. I mean, the Brits are a prime example of that. I mean, they were pretty much almost like a segregated society from the Afghans.
They were a segregated society. Afghans live in compounds, but the British lived in great big compounds. They brought their British life in. They brought, you know, chandeliers, polo horses, whatever. They had balls, they had teas, they had amateur theatricals. And they didn't mingle really with the general Afghan society at all.
Our guest, by the way, if you've just joined us, is Tommy Mansari, San Francisco-based author of a new book called Games Without Rules, the often interrupted history of Afghanistan. And when people think of Afghanistan today, of course, they think of divisiveness and tribes and tribal warfare, but they also think of opium and corruption and U.S. involvement. And yet what you do here, and I think it's very important, is you give us a picture of people who are very distinctive individual people, you know, who have their own rules, as you suggest, and who have lived by their own rules, despite the fact that others have tried to make them bend to their rules.
Yes. Well, you know, they lived originally in a... And I say originally, but that Afghanistan still exists. It's a world of villages. It's a world governed by, you know, emerging from the grassroots leaders, elders, clerics, self-governing. And so that was the original Afghanistan, and its customs and traditions was what governed it.
Excuse me. You say the story begins with Ahmad Shah. Tell us about Ahmad Shah.
Well, Ahmad Shah was a charismatic young man. Yeah. And he was originally, you'd call him Ahmad Khan, but Shah means king. So he was a young fellow who had been an aide to the Persian emperor. And when the Persian empire collapsed, he ended up being elected by the Pashtun chiefs as the guy who was going to hold them together just long enough to withstand what was coming probably from the west. As it happened, once he got that scepter in his hands, he went out conquering and he built an empire. And that empire pretty much is the seed of what Afghanistan is today.
In fact, he was, I think you've said, maybe even tougher than Bismarck, although you made the comparison of Bismarck.
Actually, you know, he was probably tough. I'm sure he was tough. I made that comparison to a later king, Amir Abdurrahman Khan, the Iron Amir. And...
That was a guy who had 40 wars in 21 years, right?
Yeah.
And but also brought a lot of those tribal elders together. He was paying off the mullahs, right?
Well, both of those guys brought the elders together. Now, we shouldn't confuse them. Ahmad Shah Khan, Ahmad Shah Baba, he was a conqueror and known for that. But in Afghan history, his legend also has all these charismatic, gracious, gentlemanly qualities that people... I don't know if they're true, but that's the apocryphal image. This guy later, he was 1880 to 1900. Afghanistan remembers him as a guy who was just grim beyond belief. And yeah, he paid off the elders. He also instituted a spy system that put them in prison, you know, if they stirred. He used every means at his disposal to try to create an Afghanistan that he could rule from his one capital.
When we spoke before of Ahmad Shah, I was struck by the fact that when I think of Shah, I think of Pahlavi and, you know, the peacock throne and Iran. There's a tremendous influence, really, of Persian influence in Afghanistan ongoing.
There is, you know, in ancient times, there was no border there. So the Persian-speaking territory includes quite a bit of Afghanistan. It's the area known as Khorasan. It's more in the north. And many of the famous poets of Persian literature actually lived and worked in Afghanistan.
Like
so
Rumi.
That was indistinct. Who?
Rumi.
Yeah, Rumi was born in Afghanistan, grew up there, then crossed what we now call Iran to end up in Turkey, where he lived out his life.
It was a territory and not a country, though, we should emphasize here, and became a country around the same time the United States became a country.
Right. It was a territory, indistinct, no real borders. And when somebody put together an empire, as this man Ahmad Shah did, he didn't do the things we think of governments and nation states as having. He didn't build schools. He didn't have police force. He didn't do all that kind of stuff. He mustered the troops. He went out conquering.
Well, nobody cared who the emperor was, really, did they?
As long as he wasn't in the neighborhood, they didn't care. If he came around, yes, oh, yes, sir, you know, whatever.
But no central government in daily life, really.
In daily life, no. And you know, even 30 years later, 40 years later, when there was another big king known by all as the King of Afghanistan, he didn't have a cabinet. He didn't have a, you know, ministry of this and ministry of that. He really ruled with the help of one guy, who you would call a Lord Chamberlain sort of a guy, and then his relatives.
And what about the tribal elders in all this?
Well, the tribal elders, we should call them village elders because not all Afghans are tribal. But the village elders were local guys, And they were whoever had the most prestige locally. And, you know, the decisions were made in sort of a village council sort of way. But obviously the guys with the most prestige had the most influence. And there were people who had the acknowledged sort of respect of everybody. Their word went. But it was not an appointed or an elected thing. They just existed all over the place.
Why did the Soviets decide to get involved in Afghanistan?
Well, by the time the Soviets came around, the social fabric of Afghanistan was a tense balance of opposites. The rural countryside was wanting to return to the original Afghanistan. The modernists in the city were pushing for change. And the whole thing, the whole apple cart was overturned when a underground communist party, Afghans, overthrew the monarchy, took over, seized power, and then they couldn't hold it. And as their power eroded and the country fragmented, the Soviet Union saw possible trouble on its border. They were worried that the U.S. was going to move in, and that's, you know, part of the Cold War containment battle. And in order to prevent the U.S., they came in and took hold of Afghanistan so it would not leave the Soviet sphere.
In fact, I well remember the you point this out in your book, that the Afghans were able to play both sides of the Cold War. It was like, remember that movie, The Mouse That Roared?
yes.
A little country that, I mean, they got a lot of development money out of the Cold War.
They got a lot of development money. The ruling elite at that point, mostly the ruling family and then the technocrats that they had educated, sent to the West to be educated, those guys were very clever about how they played the Cold War game. And, you know, in my book, I describe some of the, the town of Lashkargah where I grew up, the little town of Kajakai that was built by some eccentric, Italian guy who created all the sidewalks. They built roads. They built, theaters. They built all kinds of stuff. They got money from one side. They got money from the other side. On top of that diplomatic cleverness, they also were able to play the diplomatic game with the Afghans within the country. They negotiated with the tribes. They, used the marriage system to forge alliances. So they kept the country stable during the Cold War and brought the money flowing in.
Which is what bin Laden tried to do after the Mujahideen sort of vacated and Afghanistan was used as a base. I mean, marriages and so forth with but the Soviets really decimated Afghanistan. I remember asking my friend Khaled Husseini, whom I'm sure you know, author of The Kite Runner, what was worse in Afghanistan, the Soviets or the Taliban? And he said, how can you choose between two such poisons?
Really? Yeah, really. And they're related. You know, the Soviets, in an effort to conquer the country, they decided to depopulate the country. And using carpet bombing and a host of other horrible things, they chased millions of Afghan families into refugee status. They tore those families apart because
they were trying
to
depopulate, really, weren't they?
They were trying to depopulate because the guerrillas they didn't need to go across the border to get shelter. They had shelter in every village. So they said, let's get rid of the villages. Then when the refugees ended up in the camps, that's where the Taliban respond. So these two things are not unrelated. And the Taliban coming in are such an extreme version of the conservative end of the Afghan cultural fabric. They are that conservative end transformed into sort of a nightmare.
Well, some... Excuse me. Still fighting my cold, trying to fight it. Some will tell us that the Taliban are not the unified group that they're presented as. There's just, a lot of them are really plebeian Afghans and people from the countryside and so forth and Islamic believers, but they seem to be, a highly organized militant group. And yet, I think they're sort of a melange of different groups.
They're a melange of different groups. They're sort of the tendency at the extreme right wing of Afghan culture. Now, it should be said the Taliban started out as a entity. They were forged by Pakistan. They were sent into Afghanistan, or they came into Afghanistan as a more or less organized group. But after the U.S. came in and decimated them and they fled, that fragmented, and in the fragmentation, a host of other groups, a host of successor groups rose up with allegiance to that Talibanist kind of reactionary right-wing Islamist ideology. But they're Afghans pursuing an age-old Afghan contest.
But you read your book and you come to the realization that in some ways Afghanistan still is, as they said when the United States decided to go into Afghanistan, in the Stone Age in the 12th century. But in some ways it's really in the 21st century. And this is the remarkable kind of paradox of it, that you've got a country where where there are computers and hydroelectric power and solar panels and TV sets and satellites, and then you've got a country where people are living pretty much like they lived in the 12th century.
Yeah, but they have absorbed, and they are absorbing rapidly, all this new technology. And I think we think that technology that we have, when it goes into another society, it'll make them socially just like we are. That's not what happens with technology. People absorb it into their own lives and use it in their own ways. The technology has started to penetrate into even the most remote parts of Afghan society. Now, I haven't been there, but I heard that there's a place in the northern eastern corner of Afghanistan where you can't drive to on a car. And people have brought in these little these hydroelectric plants part by part and reassembled them in these places. They use the power from that on these little streams to generate electricity, which they can power TV sets with, and they have satellite dishes. And in these places, they can gather in the mosque, or in the women can gather in the women's home, and they can watch soap operas. They can watch news from Kabul, and they do.
But it still seems, I mean, not to jump ahead here too much, it seems like the country is, I mean, there's Kabul and there's Karzai and then there's everything else out there.
That's correct, yeah. It's a divided country still. You know, I went to central Afghanistan, Bamyan, this spring, and I went from Kabul. And, you know, 50 miles, or not 50, 30 miles out of Kabul, it looks like it did when I was a kid. And by the time you get to Bamyan, I have this anecdote in my book I relate. The little town of Bamyan looks like the little towns of my childhood, with little vendors set up along the street all along there. And I expect to come and see that they're cutting hair or selling, falooda, which is syrup-flavored snow. But no, they have little personal solar panels, and they are powering a 12-volt battery, and that's hooked up to a computer. That computer somehow is able to connect to the internet, and they're downloading songs from Pakistan, and they're selling them to people passing by to load into their mobiles, into their cell phones. But the people look like, you know, some of those people have these turbans and beards and all that, but this technology has settled in. I think it's a pretty remarkable suggestive, kind of intriguing situation.
I think you also remarked the last time you were in Kabul that you were terrified but also energized.
I was. You know, everybody in Kabul, my sense of it was that people are paranoid. And I didn't see any violence myself. But my relative there did take me to a restaurant, a high-end restaurant. It did look like a maximum security prison from the outside. You did have to go through two levels of security in which your car was searched and you're patted down for weapons before you entered a garden of paradise with fountains and flowers and trees and great, gorgeous, elegant food in this restaurant with a band playing. And right outside the maximum security walls, you know, like 100 feet away, there's people begging. There's people living in containers, you know, the big metal containers, whole families living in there. It's a divided society right inside of Kabul. And the tension of that kind of contrast, you can feel it. And at the same time, everywhere you look, people are on the make. People are found a way to, you know, take leftover shoes and turn them into something they're making by hand on the street and vending. They've got a little business. It's just
there's
glamorous.
Not that woe is me self-pitying going on among these Afghan people.
I didn't see any woe is me self-pity. Boy, that's an energetic, vigorous society over there.
Talking to Tommy Mansari, his new book is Games Without Rules. And let me open the phone lines. We can talk some more about Afghanistan, its history, and Afghanistan today, and perhaps what we can look to in the future, but we certainly welcome your involvement in the program and invite you to join the conversation if you have some thoughts or if you have some questions. You can call us now. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. We do welcome your phone call, so feel free to join the conversation. Again, it's toll-free, and you can join us now at 866-733-6786. number of other ways you can communicate any questions or comments you have. Particularly be interesting to hear from some of you who have Afghan roots or have been to Afghanistan or particularly have some thoughts about the future of Afghanistan, as well as maybe questions, again, about the past of Afghanistan. This is a pretty comprehensive and yet succinct history. Our email address is forum@kqed.org, or you can post any questions or comments you might have on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or go to our Facebook page and post anything you have there. And I should mention, by the way, Mir Tamimaseri, mother was the first American woman to marry an Afghan and to live in Afghanistan, yeah?
Yeah, that's correct. Uh-huh.
How'd that happen?
Well, that was in the period when the Afghan government first started sending Afghan boys abroad to be educated at a Western university. My father was in one of those early waves. He was sent to Chicago, and he was doing his graduate work at University of Chicago. He was living in a boarding house, and somebody else who had a room there was my mother. She was the daughter of Finnish immigrants, first-generation American. They met. They fell in love. They got married. She said, I'm going back to Afghanistan with you. He said, it's not going to be easy. He told her everything he could about, you know, things like no plumbing and and the primitive cooking conditions and so on. And he mentioned that, you know, women are sequestered, but she didn't quite absorb all that he said about that. And she went with him. And, you know, she discovered that women had to wear a chadari or a burqa, as it's called now. And she refused to wear it, so she never wore that in Afghanistan. She started teaching at the first girls' school, became the first American to teach girls to speak English there.
I can hear somebody saying now that maybe there would be a Taliban trying to throw acid at her or something along those lines because she was an educator.
Well, in those days, it wasn't like that. You know, in those days, these Taliban and the acid throwing and stuff, this is a distortion of even the conservative end of Afghan culture. Now, Afghan culture was very conservative at that point. And my grandmother and the Afghan women in my family, they did not go out without a chadari. They rarely went out at all. But along with all of that, society was imbued with a sense of respect and, you know, communal upholding the honor of your family. There was a lot of restraint as well as conservatism in Afghan society. These recent wars have blown that to bits, and so it's a jungle in there now.
And it's become more retrograde, gone backwards, you know, even more?
It has, yeah. I mean, the reactionary end, the conservative end of Afghan culture has become reactionary. Even the reactionary end has become extremist and violent. So that darkness does exist in Afghan society.
It's also interesting to hear that your mother was Finnish-American, because there was a period where Finnish-Americans were almost in they were in kind of a subaltern role. They were, you know, I remember I think it's in The Great Gatsby, somebody talks about my Finn, and he means, you know, the servant woman who's working for him, who happens to be Finnish. There was a definite kind of stratification. We're talking with Tamim Ansari. His new book is Games Without Rules, and if you have something you'd like to contribute to this conversation about Afghanistan, its history, present-day Afghanistan, and Afghanistan's future, we're really trying to look at the whole picture here, and you may have a question or comment. Toll-free, you can join us now, 866-733-6786. You can also tweet us if you're on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum, or email us, forum@kqed.org. We'll hear from you when we return. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Author Tamim Ansari, a San Francisco-based author, is here with us this hour, and he's written a book on the history of Afghanistan, which is often understood in terms of invasions. The area has been occupied by Alexander the Great and Genghis Khan, and more recently, of course, the Soviet Union and the United States-led NATO coalition. But the country has its own compelling story, independent of interventions. So writes San Francisco-based author Tamim Ansari, who is also an editor and educator. And join us for this hour to talk about Games Without Rules, the often interrupted history of Afghanistan. And if you have some thoughts or questions about Afghanistan, you are also welcome to join the show. Toll-free number 866-733-6786, or email us forum@kqed.org, or post any question or comment you might have on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on the segment. Let's go first to you, Peter. You're on. Good morning.
Good morning. Salam alaikum, Mawlana Ansari.
Salam.
I was in Afghanistan for 7 months, and I'd already been in Iran and learned Farsi, which is the same as Dari, which is the, what they speak in western and northern Afghanistan. And I was a doctor in a little clinic, no running water, no electricity, but that's another story.
Excuse me, Peter, aren't you still a doctor? Once a doctor,
yes,
always
well,
a doctor.
Well, I've retired now. But anyhow, I love the Afghans. I love their cheerfulness and quick wit and love of poetry, and their just agreeable, wonderful people. But the attitude towards women was just execrable. And just for example, I had to go to a clinic in a little town northeast of Zarange, where I was stationed mainly. And one day there were a bunch of us, people, mainly men, hanging around the clinic and doing various things in the town. And we were stuck in the rain for a while. So I said to the guys, and this is in Farsi, of course, or Dari, you have a good boys' school here. Why don't you build a girls' school? And there was this long pause, as though I'd, I don't know, start to take off my pants or something. It was just a shocked pause. And then one of the men said, with real vicious emphasis, I would fight first. And now these are ordinary, nice Afghan Muslims, and I think Mr. your guest will agree that I was in a, you know what, I like these people, they interested me, they fascinated me, but it's going to take several generations, or at least two or three generations, to alter their attitude toward women and allow women to have something like parity in their society.
Well, you know, the question of women and their role in society and the relationship between the genders is the crucial dividing line and the point of conflict in Afghan culture. And one thing that, you know, I think some people who read my book will be surprised to learn that this is not something new, that there has been a struggle over this question going back to the beginning of this, of the last century, beginning of the 20th century. And I want to say that in the 30 or 40 years, between, let's say, 1930 and the beginning of the 1970s, when Afghanistan had, because of the machinations of that royal family, it had a certain cultural sovereignty and political autonomy, that society moved on the question of women's rights to a degree that I think very few societies have gone through that much change in that short a time. The West certainly didn't. It took hundreds of years for the West to arrive where it did. And that experience tells me that there are conditions in which Afghan society would move, change, progress. That would happen. But it's all interwoven with other questions now. And, you know, in the urban areas, among educated urban families, the attitude about women and the question of gender roles and the question of education for girls, I think men are on board and women are chomping at the bit. And Kabul has, you know, pronounced and powerful feminist voices that are operating in that society.
We had one of them on here, Malalaya Joya.
Oh, yes,
who's a member
right.
of parliament, very strong voice, to put it mildly. But, you know, Greg Mortensen has been trying to build these schools in Afghanistan for girls. Of course, he ran into some problems with a scandal recently and so forth. But it's been tremendous resistance. Throughout the countryside, particularly.
Yeah, there has been resistance because this domestic struggle that has been going on in Afghanistan for over 100 years, the urban elite versus the rural situation, elders, clerics, but also just the social structure out there. That thing is all interwoven with the question of women because old original Afghanistan was set up in a certain the form of the society was public world belonged to men, private world was men and women together. The private world was the actual world in which people lived, and it was all about, you know, the way that society ran. That is not going to happen in the future. Those days are over, and the destruction of those old ways has all the people out there are fighting it, and the men have the control. And the problem for
women don't play buzkashi, huh? Women don't play buzkashi.
Women do not play buzkashi, although women play games without rules in that private world that you don't know about and that my caller doesn't know about, but that I know about because when I go to Afghanistan, I'm in that world and I go to the village and I hear what's going on and the women are, you know, criticizing me and berating me for things I don't or do. The struggle is going on, but it's not separate from the other struggle, which is Afghanistan elite urban versus rural, and the other struggle besides that, which is Western powers inside Afghanistan trying to dominate the culture. The problem I was going to say is that beyond the reach of Western powers, that old Afghanistan still exists. And in that Afghanistan, men have the power over women. And to the extent that that culture feels like it's threatened by an outside power that wants to change them, those men are going to take it out on who they have control over. And they're going to take it out on the women. And we can't protect those women.
Well, so, Peter, I thank you for the call. Read your book and realize how Afghanistan is wrestling for identity and questions of power, but definition. I mean, it still is an ongoing process and an ongoing story. Let me bring some more of our callers in here. We'll go next to Ian. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm calling from Walnut Creek, and I was in Afghanistan in 1971. I passed through the country, and I really agreed with your guest's comment about what a proud, respectful culture it was back in those days. We actually drove there, came overland all the way from England. And in Iran, my girlfriend at the time couldn't walk out in the streets without getting harassed and touched. And we drove through these small villages, people would like stop everything to see a woman driving a Ford van, and what a scandalous thing to do. But we had the feeling in Afghanistan of just being people, very proud people, very respectful, very courteous. It was a very different feeling to the way Iran felt at the time under the Shah. And I just wanted to make that comment. And I'd like to know this guest's book. I don't know the title of his book. I'm eager to read it. I read everything I can about Afghanistan.
Well, it's called Games Without Rules, just so you know.
And it's called what?
Games Without Rules.
Okay.
Got it, Ian?
Games
That's
Without Rules.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. And we thank you for the call. Tamim, you want to respond? A lot of people love the Afghan people. In fact, looking at an email here, it says, I'm happy we're preparing to leave Afghanistan, but should we be more worried about Pakistan? Let's talk about this just for a moment, though. I mean, the relationship between Pakistan and Afghanistan, you can't separate them.
You know, again, one of the stories that I trace out in my book is the fact that in its forming, Afghanistan originally felt that a part of what is now Pakistan was part of Afghanistan. That's a question in Afghan political history that goes back to the very beginning. And in the days of Ahmad Shah Baba, the father of Afghanistan, Peshawar, and you know that part of Pakistan was part of the Afghan empire. So now, the process
Pakistan
of
Pakistan also broke off from India, of course.
Huh?
I say, lest we forget, Pakistan also broke off from India.
Right. At that time, it was just part of India. And now, but the thing is, settling that border, drawing a specific border, is one of the dramas that has been ongoing in Afghan history. And one of the things that enabled it to start to formulate as a nation state was at least, you know, having a definite place where Afghanistan ended and something else began. Now, it's true the British drew that border, but whatever, it was a border. One of the things that's happening now is that border is somewhat dissolving. That whole belt from, you know, on the Afghan side to a large part of the Pakistan side, that's like one terrain. It's one set of tribal culture. It's not this one tribe, but it's many tribes. They straddle the border, and they don't particularly belong to either of the nation states, and that's very problematic.
And we go to more of our calls, and we go next to you, Paul. Join us. Hi.
Oh, hello.
Yes.
Thank you for the show. I had a question. In looking at the entertainment that they choose Do they play video games? Do they watch shows that have violence in them like we do over here, or have they had enough of it in the streets?
Well, I was struck by a show I saw this spring when I was in Afghanistan. It was a reality show documentary reenactment of the most colorful and compelling recent kidnapping. And so you might call it a kidnapping of the week show. And I was sort of taken aback, and especially because the possibility of being kidnapped for ransom was omnipresent in Kabul culture. And so they don't eschew violence. Although a lot of the shows are not about violence, there's a lot of singing shows, talk shows, that kind of thing.
Let me thank the caller. I keep getting back, though, in my head to how, how ununited in some ways Afghanistan is as a nation. There's the notion that Americans have that the Mujahideen were fighting against the Soviets. There were hundreds of groups fighting against the Soviets. They were all scattered, all fragmented.
Yeah, there were. There was the fact that there were hundreds of Mujahideen groups, and there was 80 supposed official Mujahideen parties, roughly that number, in Peshawar within a few years of the Soviet invasion. But those 80 groups were not even how fragmented it was, because they didn't actually represent armies in the country. And the fragmentation that was represented by the Mujahideen is the process that makes Afghanistan so difficult to actually govern, and the non-governability of it is what makes it difficult for foreigners to come in and dominate.
That's a major theme in your book, of course, is the non-governability. But it's hard to separate the bad guys here, too, sometimes, isn't it? We tend to think of the Taliban as largely the bad guys, but in many respects, you've got, like I said, ordinary Afghans who join the Taliban for whatever reason.
Well, I think it's one of the less productive thing is to think of it in terms of bad guys and good guys. And I think the casual use of the term bad guys, especially in the military context and American military, usually even the official communications has fallen into that. The reason that phrase is used is because it's so difficult to define who are the other guys. And so you can say bad guys and then you kind of know who they are. But who are those guys? If you had to give a name to them other than bad guys, who would you be talking about?
The Americans thought John Lynn Walker, for example, was one of the bad guys. Anybody who joined the Taliban was suspect and still is suspect, I guess.
Well, and also what's important to realize, there's people who are not Taliban, and then they become Taliban, and then they're not Taliban again, because it's not a you don't have to fill out a registration slip and get a badge to be a Taliban, to be a Talib, I should say.
Let me bring in Dylan here. Dylan, join us. Hi.
Yeah, hi. Had a question for your guest. Question or comment around the whole Mortensen brouhaha. I know it started in Pakistan when he wandered off the glacier, but my understanding, actually having read his book and kind of followed it in the media, is that he has done some good things, but there's been a lot of questioning of either his motives or his means, and I just wanted to get a comment on that.
I think most of the questions we did a program on this had to do with money that was spent, but he certainly has done some good. There's no question about that.
Yeah, I'm sure he's done some good, and I don't know what he did that wasn't good. I don't want to comment on Greg Mortensen because I don't really know enough about him.
For listeners' sake, he's the author of Three Cups of Tea and built some schools in Afghanistan and Pakistan both.
Yeah, and as I understand it, Mortensen built schools in very remote areas. When I met him a few years ago, they said they were going to build schools in that little thumb of land that is very inaccessible and pokes up into China. So that's one thing. But the school issue is very big in Afghanistan, because for a while, the one thing every person who was interested in doing some good in Afghanistan did was they went over there and they built a school, and they built it in the areas where they felt the need for particularly girls' education was the greatest. And those were the areas that were the most troubled by insurgency. And I think that the turning point in Afghan, in this current Afghan war, came in 2006 or so, when the insurgents began to realize that the most shocking, horrifying, and traumatic thing they could do was to attack schools, and they did that. They burned or otherwise forced the closure of some 200 schools in the violence-laden region. And you might say, well, how does that help the insurgency? Well, it helps it because it creates trauma, shock, and makes it much harder to create a sense of civil order and a sense of security about the future of life going on. So, you know, that provided an opportunity for those guys. On the other hand, it is absolutely true that secular education somehow has to come into Afghanistan and pervade the country for the progressive changes to happen that people like me would like to see.
There seems to be real opposition and violence. That young girl, for example, who was shot at recently and became a cause célèbre throughout Afghanistan, many people sympathized tremendously with her, but, you know, there was... So that pocket of opposition is so strong and fierce.
Well, you know, I'm going to quote myself here in the book. I said that when...
Totally permissible, yeah.
Yeah. What I said there is that when there's a war of ideas going on, and that's what we do have, when there's a war of ideas, building a school is an act of war. It's so casually said, oh, they don't want schools there. The other guys... Do I dare call them the bad guys? I'm sorry.
You said to keep that out of the way.
But those guys are all for schooling. They just want their schools, madrasas, where you only teach the Islamist ideology and reactionary. So they like schools, but schooling is a point of conflict. It's a line of scrimmage.
Let me thank the caller, and we'll go right on to another call here. But is there still, in your judgment, this ongoing sense of liaison or connection between, say, extremist factions like al-Qaeda or what is broadly described as the Arab influence in Afghanistan and the Afghan people, the Taliban?
Well, you know, the official word I hear is that that's fading. There's less and less of these al-Qaeda-style Islamists in Afghanistan. They've moved to Yemen, to Mali, other places.
To Pakistan. Yeah.
To Pakistan. I think it is true that... that the insurgency that you see in Afghanistan is mostly a continuation of the old Afghan stories. So that's true. On the other hand, I'll just pop an anecdote in here. When I was there this spring and we were in Parwan, it was a province right next to Kabul. It's not that far from Kabul. We went to a school there and I heard some pretty strange things from young kids, 10 years old, 11 years old. They were, talking about kafirs, infidels, how they're going to burn in hell. And I heard some, so I was thinking, who are these guys studying with? Then my comrades did a little program in the school there, and there was one supposed student who was much older. And the village said they didn't know where he was from, but he had come from some other region, and he was going to school here. He spoke Farsi in an accent that we thought did not sound like he was from Afghanistan, and he began to rant and preach, and I felt like, I don't know who this guy is, but somebody has come in here. And, in Parwan province now, recently, you've seen some really hideous jihadist al-Qaeda-style actions, like the videotaped beheading of a woman.
Talking again, if you've just joined us, with Tamim Ansari and his new book, is A History of Afghanistan. He subtitles it The Often Interrupted History of Afghanistan. The title of the book, again, is Games Without Rules. And Jonathan, join us. Hi. Jonathan?
Yes, hi.
Hi.
I was wondering what your guest's opinion is as far as the current international borders place sections of historic Afghanistan, and the things I'm thinking about is primarily the tribal areas and South Waziristan in Pakistan, or I believe segments are in Iran. How does that international versus cultural historic border impact the government, the insurgency, and the culture?
Well, it's obvious that the so-called Durand Line has been a longstanding problem in Afghan culture. On both sides of that line, you have Pashtuns living, and they have the same language. There's even cousins that live on both sides of the line. I'll have to say that I myself am not very favorably inclined to nation states that are defined ethnically. I just think there's no end to that. I think the The solution in the future lies in nations that are defined by procedure and process and shared rules. There's always going to be people who are not inside the same border as their ethnic cousins. And I just think it's better to define a nation in a different way.
There's been more Pashtun influence and, I mean, hegemony, really, than other tribes, other groups, other
There has been. Yeah. Now, you know, it's true that if that border were to move and all of the Pashtuns in Pakistan were to become part of Afghanistan, all of a sudden the Pashtuns would become the overwhelming majority of Afghanistan. Then the other ethnic groups would be completely dominated. But let's remember, the second biggest group is the Tajiks. They have a whole country across their border, Tajikistan. You know, are you going to... Where does it end? I think you have to just decide. This is the nation state. Let's live together.
Well, please feel free to join us here in the time remaining. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786, or you can email us, forum@kqed.org. And we'll go to Cupertino and welcome Susan. Susan, you're on. Hi.
Hello. My mother came here, and my father, in 1982, and I was born shortly after. And growing up in America, being... like, very much a Californian. There's a lot of ignorance towards Afghans, and I just wanted to thank your guest for writing this book, but also ask him, what do you think the implications are of writing this book, and do you think that spreading this kind of awareness socially will have a political impact in the long run?
Well, you know, part of the reason I wrote this book was to write a book that wasn't just about, you know, today's bloodshed, the withdrawal, the questions about politics of extremism. I wanted to write a book that included that earlier sense of Afghan history, the colorful characters, the compelling stories, and the descriptions of the times of peace, in order to at least enable an American readership. This book is written for an American audience, to enable them to have a sense of Afghanistan that isn't just about the current war. So I don't see a direct political consequence, but I actually think having a larger, more humane, more inclusive view of another country like Afghanistan has political consequences that are more important than the immediate effects of the book.
Well, the other history in terms of large powers of Afghanistan is Afghanistan's been abandoned. You know, I mean, there's still a great deal of hue and cry about the fact that the United States did not stay and did not do more than it could have done. I'm not talking about soldiers. I'm talking about development aid and helping with building schools and the things we've been talking about here. Actually, a listener tweets... interesting question. What role should Afghan Americans and the larger diaspora play in post-2014 Afghanistan?
Oh, that's a that's an interesting question. Well, you know, the thing is the kind of engagement that Americans can have with Afghanistan requires that there be a sense of the humanity of the other on both sides. And I think that the military presence of the United States has forestalled that. It's not conducive to that. So I think that going from now to 2014 and then after, if I may be so immodest as to say, books like mine and other communications that enlarge the view of the other on both sides, that's going to be helpful in an engagement of Americans in Afghanistan afterwards. And I think Americans should be and will be engaged in Afghanistan afterwards. I will also mention that kind of understanding of the other is requisite for Afghans, too. That the image has fallen away there, and it's sad.
There's also the sense that, Americans have stereotyped in their mind too much of extremist behavior, and there's still a woeful and pervasive amount of corruption in today's Afghanistan.
There is. And, you know, Afghanistan will sort that out when and if it has a political process that is autonomous and sovereign. The sorting out of that may not be to the liking of other countries, because there's some aspects of this corruption that are also interwoven with Afghan culture and an expression of Afghan culture. I don't know how it's going to come out. You know,
oh, you sound optimistic, though.
Strangely enough, I am optimistic. I got very depressed in the course of writing this book. But by the time I was done, I thought, you know, life comes, life goes. There's always change. The good times won't come again, but other good times may.
And what do you envision as may be good times.
When do I envision it?
No, not when, but what would that constitute? I mean, we're not talking about a utopia here. What would be good times for Afghanistan?
Good times for Afghanistan would be that the country is stable and the sense of warfare has died away between the city and the country, the rurals and the secular elite, and the influx of technology, I think, and communications, perhaps even more than schools, the fact that people in all areas are seeing the same TV shows. You
so
know,
peace the, and a lack of isolation, really. Huh?
Peace, a lack of isolation, and a sense of unity amongst different Afghans, a sense of sharing a common culture, which I think could happen.
Well, it would be nice to see it happen and brought to fruition. In the meantime, this is an important book, and I congratulate you for having written it and given it to us. Tamim Ansari, who is also the author of Destiny Disrupted and west of Kabul, east of New York. His new book is A History of Afghanistan. It's called Games Without Rules, The Often Interrupted History of Afghanistan. So good to have you with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me on.
And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Tomorrow, if all goes according to plan, I hope the diminution of this cold that I'm fighting, if everything goes according to plan, I'll be here and be talking in this hour about California accents. Believe it or not, there's Stanford research now that is showing that there are indeed California accents. Well, what do they mean, and do you have them, and do you hear them, and what does it tell us about this region perhaps that we should know? That's at least slated for tomorrow. Thanks for being with us. You can always continue discussions on our website, kqed.org/forum, or go to our Facebook page. And we thank those behind the scenes here. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our producers are Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Larberg. Engineer is Danny Bringer, and executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.